tonight I am incredibly excited and thrilled and overwhelmed to have Mads Tergesen, who is the lead designer on C#. Mads, how are you?
I'm great. I'm pretty excited too.
I want to talk to you about C# 8 and all of the cool new features. But before I do, I've often been curious about what your day is like. What is it like to be a designer of a major language? How do you spend your time?
Yeah, well, I'm fundamentally what we call a program manager, which means generally that there are a lot of different activities involved. But, you know, in terms of designing C#, it's sort of split between the solo technical work of sitting down to write out proposals or work through some difficult syntax or semantics problem or something like that. And then on the other end of it, there's going out and talking to developers, you know, going to events, giving talks, but also having conversations with people who use the language and trying to understand what would be most beneficial to what's the thing most missing in the language that we have a shot at doing. But then in between, this, I think the most exciting for me is, in some ways, is maybe the most unique to our process, is that we have these language design meetings that are 4 hours a week of a group of people sitting together in a room and actually collectively doing the work, the creative work, if you will, of designing C#, of debating and coming up with solutions to the hard problems and so on. And that's really where the sausage gets made. That is where C# comes into existence, if you will.
And when you start thinking about a feature that you might like to have, do you know right away, oh, this is going to be really difficult, or this, I know exactly how to do this, it's just a question of what the syntax is? How does that play out?
Yeah, I often know right away, and then I'm often wrong about that. Sometimes, you know, some features seem simple on the surface, and then you start scratching, and it turns out that it gets more and more complex the more you try to unravel it. So it's definitely, it's not a given that just because the idea seems simple, then the actual feature is.
One of the experiences I think all developers have is that the person they're working for thinks, oh, that'll be trivial, you should have that tomorrow.
Yeah.
Right? Or they'll look at something and say, oh, that must be really hard, and you can do it in 10 minutes. So it's very hard to, if you're not in the middle of it, it's hard to understand how long it's going to take. And even if you are in the middle of it, creating estimates is just the bane of everyone's existence.
No, that is true. Yeah, I guess in that sense, language design isn't so much different. I think one of the things that we often run up against is that we need to maintain compatibility with previous versions of the language. And, you know, as the language fills in more and more with more and more things you can say, it's hard to fit a feature in there without it shoving up against some other feature, you know? So there are these weird interactions, either syntactically, you know, oh, that actually is ambiguous now. That could mean the new thing or the old thing, and, you know, some specific utterance or sequence of characters. Now, all of a sudden, we have to figure out what you meant. Or it could be more semantically that the features interact in some semantic way that we have to untangle. So those are often the ways that a feature becomes extremely complicated at the end.
I can't quite imagine that level of complexity, because you're building this enormous, complex compiler that has to be not only add new features, but be backwards compatible for fairly far back, I assume.
Yeah, pretty much all the way.
All the way to Kernighan and Ritchie.
What's that?
I said all the way down to Kernighan and Ritchie.
Well, all the way back to C# 1. We don't go further back than that. We don't care about compat with old versions of C. Okay. But still, we have a 20-year history almost. So that's a lot of compat. And usually, you know, it's incremental. So it's one version at a time. But there was one time that we did have to deal with the compatibility all the way back. And that was when we built the Roslyn compiler, which is to say we re-implemented C# in C#. And that was top to bottom re-implementation. And there we really had to make sure that we were compatible with the old compiler for the whole language. And that's extremely hard, because the old compiler had a bunch of bugs, actually, where it behaved differently than the spec. So we couldn't just sit down and implement the language spec again. We also had to port the bugs, so to speak, make sure that wrong behavior that people could depend on would continue to be wrong in the new version, including in places where we didn't know it existed. So that was quite a challenge. That's really when we always had a decent test infrastructure or a decent set of language tests, but that's really when we boosted the whole thing, you know, through the roof in terms of testing, because we need to make sure that everything worked the same.
You have a guess how many unit tests there are for C#?
No, I have lost track of that.
Okay, let's talk about some of the new amazing things in C# 8. because at least to my eyes, C Sharp 8 is one of the biggest jumps that we've seen for a while. A really significant new features. Is that your perception as well?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I think in particular, I mean, there are several big features in C-Sharp 8, and particular one of them, I think, is probably the most impactful feature that we added probably since async. It's sort of in that same order, and that's nullable reference type. That is a feature that touches everything. You know, it's huge, and it has the same complexities as async did in terms of not just being a language feature, but also bringing in, you can say, new patterns that people have to apply in their APIs. And so there's a whole rollout to the world that has to follow the actual release of the language feature itself.
Can you talk a little bit about what it is and why you chose to put it into the language?
Yeah, well, we've sort of had this, we had this dirty secret, in, especially in object-oriented programming, for actually the last half century since it was invented in Norway in 1968. Which is null, right? We object-oriented programming is very much about having types that represent concepts of, you know, everyday concepts like nouns, if you will. And, you know, so something can be a person, or it can be a vehicle, or it can be a record of something, or, you know, so that's all fair and good. But now we say null is all of the above. You know, we pretend that null is an object of that fits all types, where really it's null is not everything. Null is nothing, right? And so you can assign null to all of these things, but whenever you then go and try to use it as one of these types, when you dereference, essentially, you know, you get an explosion. So we have this systematic way of putting little explosions into the language. And that's just been around for all these 50 years now. And we felt, you know, maybe we have a shot at, if not eliminating that problem, then definitely getting much more of a handle on it, sort of a compile time handle, a type system handle, if you will, on the null, so that not that you can't have them anymore, but that when you do, we know that you do, and we tell you when you're about to explode, right? We tell you whether you are handling your null safely.
Tell us that at compile, or actually at the very beginning, in Visual Studio, not at runtime.
Exactly. As you compile, or even as you're typing, right? It becomes another warning in your, another squiggle. As soon as you do something null unsafe, it pops up and shows you. And so the idea is that we want you to express the difference between when something should possibly be null and when it shouldn't. So between nullable and non-nullable reference type. And so we do, in order to make that useful, even for existing code and not just for new code, we do a little bit of a hack, you can say, by changing what the current reference types in the language, essentially changing them to be non-nullable. So we say from now on, reference types like string or other class types, they are no longer supposed to be null. And we will warn you if you put null in there, or if you forget to initialize the null out of them. And of course, those are warnings that may be helpful, but they're also warnings you didn't used to get on your code. So back to what we talked about with compatibility before, we do it only if you opt into this. This is a feature you have to opt into. And then you get these new warnings saying, hey, you can't, null's not a string anymore, you know? And if you want null, then you can say string question mark, the nullable string. That's a new syntax, if you will, similar to how you can already do it with value types, but now with reference types, you can declare that they're supposed to hold null. And now you're fine to stick nulls in there, but then on the other side of things, when you try to consume them, that's where we warn you if you try to dereference without checking first. So we do a flow analysis and see if you're checking that things are null before you dereference. And that keeps most of those null reference exceptions out of your code.
Wow. I've had one or two of those null reference exceptions.
Yeah, and I think most people, no one loves them, right?
Yeah, nobody likes them. And they're a little hard to track down at times. So this is a significant change, but it's not the jazziest change, because you also put in pattern matching, really advanced pattern matching, and I'll think of the other one I wanted to talk to you about in a minute. But talk to me about pattern matching, and you give this incredible demo where you start out with a fair amount of complexity, and then you. This is your Fair for Going Over a Bridge, I believe it is, demo.
Yeah, and this is the demo we've shown is also the example that is on the docs.microsoft.com page on pattern matching and on the pattern matching features in C# 8 on recursive pattern matching, as we call it. So everybody can go and have, you know, go when you've listened to this, you know, go and play with that. That's a great example that I didn't put it together. It's Bill Wagner, who's also on the team who's built that demo. But the idea is that the idea with pattern matching is to provide a terse way of testing something and then extracting information from it if the test is true. That's sort of like the pattern matching in general is. And so we have this new thing since C# 7 that's called patterns that weren't in the language before. It's a thing that's very common in functional programming languages, but it's only starting to get traction in more object-oriented programming languages such as C#. And the idea is that you can use patterns in switch statement. You can use them in is expression to do a test, and then as you test, you know, you can get some information out. So for instance, you can do a type check, like you used to be able to say if some expression is string, and now it's in C# 7, you can also say that expression is string S, and then you actually get a variable of that value as a string, if it was true, right? And so in C# 8, we've taken the next step where we've added more kinds of patterns, and in particular, what we call quote-unquote recursive patterns. Those are patterns where once you have a value that you, in a pattern that you know to be of a certain type, you can dig in and also require certain things of the members of that type, for instance. And you can apply the patterns can apply the deconstruction that we introduced in C# 7 and various other things that let you apply patterns even to the part of the values that you're switching on. So that's
Glenn.
Yeah, so that's part of what we added is more pattern and deeper pattern. But then on the other side, we also added a new kind of expression, which is the switch expression. It's essentially, you know, the expression version of switch statement, but appropriately modernized. The switch statement is probably one of the clunkiest kinds of statements that we have. It goes all the way back to Koenig and Ritchie. and it's sort of the syntax feels very last century. The switch expression is an expression form of switch that is both that, so you can use it in line as an expression, but it's also much more terse and nifty. So,
yes.
So that means you both have new places where you can use patterns, and you also have new pattern in C# 8.
Yes, I really like the switch expressions. I like what I can do with them, and I like the syntax, and they're terser, but they're also clearer, and that's a hard combination to get.
Right. That's sort of like a general trend of a lot of what we've done in C# in the last, well, since C# 6 in particular. I think that became a major trend, been a little of it before, but where we said, you know what, terser isn't always more obscure. Sometimes terser is clearer, and try to find more places in the language where things you say a lot can be said more tersely without losing the clarity. And I think this is another example of that. At least that's it's intended to be.
Yes, I think you hit the mark. Can you talk a little bit about some of the other features in C# 8?
Yeah, I think another significant one is async streams. So just like the pattern matching features are a continuation of something we've done previously, async streams is something that we dreamt of doing all the way since we added async in C# 5, which is to say that async, as we've added it back then, represents a single result that is, you know, quote unquote delayed, that you have to await, that's produced asynchronously. And what's missing there is the ability to have an asynchronous stream of results, like a contiguous ongoing stream of results that is produced over time, and having first-class language treatment for that. So that's what we added with async streams. It's sort of a combined library and language feature. So just like you had task of T be the library side of the async feature, now you have iasync enumerable of T be the library side of async streams, if you will. So people may know that IEnumerable of T is the sort of core, it's the core sequence type in .NET since generics was added. It's the one that's the basis for each when you consume them, and it's the one that is the basis for iterators, you know, the methods where you can have yield return. when you produce them, right? So if you want to consume iNormables, you write for each. If you want to produce iNormables, you write an iterator and you return some values out. And we really wanted to apply that in an async fashion as well. The old iNormables are synchronous. You know, whenever you move next, whenever you go to the next element, whether you do it manually or through a for each loop, the, you know, you're stuck. You're blocking on that. And that doesn't work if the next value is only available 3 seconds later. You know, you want to do that asynchronously. So iAsync iNormable is simply the almost completely straightforward version of iNormable, just asyncified, if you will. The moveNext method is the moveNext async method. And it returns not quite a task, but a value task, which is essentially the same thing. It returns task of T, essentially, right? So whenever you move to the next value, you need to await that call until that next value is ready. And what we added is language support for eaching over those guys with an await for each loop. You have to say await in front of it. And you can also produce them with an asynchronous iterator, which is a method that's marked async and returns an iasync enumerable of T. And then in there, you can both await async things and you can also yield return, right? So it's a combination of iterators and async methods. So that's quite powerful. Lets you process streams of data and yield out, you know, modified results or group results or whatever. So it lets you imagine that you have data that's streaming from a service or from an IoT device or something like that. This is what lets you both consume that with for each loop in a simple way in the language and also produce your own of such streams by combining or producing your own. So that's the general idea.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you. On the consuming end, it was a number of years ago, Paul Betts and I wrote a book on reactive extensions. And they were difficult to explain, and they were difficult to get your head around. And it feels to me like what we have now is much more intuitive, much more, well, I've done async and await, and now, you know, I'm just doing it over a set of data that may be a stream that's coming in at unpredictable amounts of time. But that's about all you have to conceptualize.
Right. I think that if you go back to some of the talks that, for instance, Eric Meyer did when reactive was new, he had a good dichotomy between iNormable of T, which is, you know, our old like sequence abstraction on the one hand, and then iObservable of T, which is the core type for reactive framework, for instance. And the idea is that one is the iNormable is pull and iObservable is push, right? So for iNormable, you ask for the next value. It's all based on the pull of the consumer, and for iObservable, the things happen at the behest of the producer, right? So a new value becomes available whenever the producer produces one, and then the way you consume it is to subscribe and have callbacks. The problem is that callbacks are hideous, right? They're you really want to limit the amount of callbacks you have in your code because they break the they essentially break all the control flow construct in your nice imperative language. Like loops don't work well. Try catch doesn't work well when you're signing up a callback to something. And so what async was about was in a large part to try to get rid of callback, I think successfully so, in the single value consumption. Async streams does the same thing, but it does it by using this asynchronous pool-based collection. So iAsync enumerable is pool-based, right? You have to ask for things. You ask asynchronously. So even though it becomes sort of more of a rendezvous kind of thing, right? Because you have to ask for it, but then you might still wait for the result for the producer to decide to produce the next result, which is sort of like the benefit of the reactive style is that the producer gets to produce results when they can. But you wait asynchronously, so you're not blocked by it, and you don't have to explicitly sign up a callback because the await infrastructure takes care of that. So it's kind of like, in some ways, it is or facilitates a merger of the two endpoints in that dichotomy.
I'm I'm sorry. I'm semi speechless because
that's not bad on a podcast.
That's right. Especially if you're the host, you're not supposed to be speechless. When 7 came out, I think it was when 7 came out or 6, I went to see Anders explain about Link and why it was. When did Link come in?
C#3.
Three. Okay, it was a long time ago. I didn't realize it was that long ago. But anyway, I went to see him explain about Link and why it existed and what it was going to do for you. And he just made it crystal clear. And you just did the same thing on asynchronous enumeration. So that was great. That was truly great.
Thanks. It's a little hard when you don't have visuals, right? I would usually at least wave my hands and preferably have a whiteboard to jot some things on. But hopefully it comes across.
Yeah, you did a verbal whiteboard, which is always great. Before I let you go, what can you say anything at all about what's coming in C# 9 or what the next steps are?
Yeah, I think I can say quite a bit. First of all, we are trying to get C# 9 out pretty quickly. And that has, so actually November of next year, or November of 2020, I should say, if people are listening to this after the New Year's. So we've now announced a fixed cadence for .NET, where we release a new version of .NET every year, starting November next year with .NET 5. And then every other of those releases is going to be an LTS release, a long-term support release, starting with .NET 6. And so we probably want to release major C-sharps on the off years where it's not a long-term support release, because generally there's a little more time to get new innovation in and less, you know, focus on stabilizing and so on. I'm not sure whether we're going to stick to that or not. It's not so much a plan as a vague intention right now, but we do want to get a quick C# 9 out. So it's not going to be as big as 8, is what I'm trying to make an excuse for here, but it's going to be soon. The most interesting things we're focused on is things that we put under the headline of quote unquote records. We want to make it easier to describe your data model. Especially, we want to help with when that data model is immutable and when you have things like value-based equality, where things are equal based on the contents rather than on the reference equality. We want to have some language support for that and some syntactic sugar, essentially, for having terse declarations of these things. But we also, I think another important thing is programming with immutable objects in general is sort of like at a disadvantage. We've done some things to make it better over the years, but it's at a disadvantage in a language like C#. And we want to try to improve on that in certain ways. And one big way is that object initializers, which were added at the time of Link, they're actually incredibly popular for initializing new objects. The problem with object initializers as a feature is that they rely on mutation. They rely on first creating the object and then assigning to the properties after. And so even if people have a data model that could be immutable, that is morally immutable, they still make it mutable just so that you can use object initializers to build the object, right? It's that attractive that they will give up on the protection of the immutability of their object. But we want to try to see if we can make it so that you can have object initializers on immutable objects. And then also another thing that we're getting a little from the functional spaces, we want to try to support non-destructive mutation. Now, what is non-destructive mutation? That sounds like an oxymoron or something. It is the idea that you create a new version of the same object, or a version that is similar to the previous one, except for specific things that you want to change. So often when you're working with immutable data, the way you do it is the way you evolve a value is to create a new version of it and store that one, right? Or you create a new version, like in Roslyn, for instance, the C# compiler, the syntax trees are immutable, but you can create a new one that's like the old one, except that this character has been added or something like that. And that's not destructive mutation. And we want to create, if we can, we want to support that in the language with primitive syntax. And we're trying to figure out how to do that. So that's the kind of thing we're looking at, and certain smaller features that are also probably coming along for the ride, including more improvements to pattern matching.
I'm looking forward to that. I think there's going to need to be a fair amount of, in addition to the one we were talking about on pattern matching, I think there's going to need to be a fair amount of documentation and talking and, you know, to really fully take advantage of pattern matching. It's not something that is immediately a C# programmer's universe, and it has huge impact.
That is true, and that is actually, I mean, that goes to a very interesting thing, actually, because C# at its roots is very object-oriented, right? And so everybody who writes code essentially typically end up quickly having some functionality that, you know, is logically the same function, but that behaves differently depending on the shape of the data that it's applied to. And when you are object-oriented, the way that you achieve that is that you have a class hierarchy, and you have virtual or abstract methods at the root, and then every class gets to say how it does the thing, right? So the way you get shape-dependent behavior is through virtual methods and overrides and the object hierarchy. And that lands you in a place that is that is sort of at the core of object-oriented programming, which is that you can always create a new derived type and let it implement the same functions in its way. So it's open to new types, but it's closed over the set of functions because you can only virtually override the functions that that were declared in the base type. So it's open type, closed functions, if you will. Now, that is not always what you want. And in particular, in a distributed world like today, where the data is often centralized and is used across many different applications, there you want the data to be fixed across these different applications, the shapes of data to be agreed upon, but each wants to have their own functionality, right? And so you want the opposite of what the object-oriented programming gives you. You want closed type, open function. And when you have that structure, this is where the functional programming languages have that opposite thing. And the way they do it is that they have pattern matching to build the shape-dependent function outside of the object themselves, right? So I can build a shape-dependent function, one that says, oh, if it's a student, do this. If it's a professor, do this. If it's this or that. I can build that very tersely and elegantly with pattern matching and the equivalent of switch expression. So that is why we borrowed in pattern matching. It's so that you can do those things when you can't be a virtual method on the core class itself, but you are a function that's declared independently of the data. Does that make sense?
Good sense. And in my experience, it also helps a lot with cutting across namespaces.
Yes, that too. And the example you mentioned before makes a point of having separate data models that aren't even declared in one go. Like in the example, there are different classes that were just independently declared, and the pattern matching brings them together and deals with all of them.